escape, but in a moment he was back, and they were running across the long, narrow lawn to the boathouse, where Master Robert floated. Drysdale had evidently christened the boat after the horse whose winning of the National had provided the money for her purchase. As the butler was fiddling with the engine, which uttered tentative spurts, Drysdale came round the end of the house with his gun, evidently just back from an afternoon on the hill, and Grant hailed him joyfully and hurriedly explained what had happened. Drysdale said not a word, but came back to the boathouse with him and said, "It's all right, Pigeon. I'll see to that, and take Mr. Grant out. Will you see that there is a good dinner waiting for two, no, three, when we get back?" Pigeon came out of the boat with an alacrity he took no trouble to hide. He gave Master Robert a push. Drysdale set the engine going, and with a roar they shot away from the jetty out into the loch. As they swerved round into their course down the loch, Grant's eyes fixed themselves on the dark speck against the pale yellow of the western sky. What would Lamont do this time? Come quietly? Presently the dark speck altered its course. It seemed to be making in to the land on the south side, and as it went away from the lighted skyline, it became invisible against the background of the southern hills. "Can you see him?" Grant asked anxiously. "I can't." "Yes, he's making in to the south shore. Don't worry, we'll be there before he makes it." As they tore along, the south shore came up to meet them in a fashion seemingly miraculous. And in a moment or two Grant could make out the boat again. The man was rowing desperately for the shore. It was difficult for Grant, unacquainted with distances on water, to measure how far he was from the shore and how far they were from him, but a sudden slackening in Master Robert's speed told him all he wanted to know. Drysdale was slowing up already. In a minute they would have overhauled him. When the boats were about 50 yards apart, Lamont suddenly stopped rowing. "Given it up," thought Grant. Then he saw that the man was bending down in the boat. "Does he think we're going to shoot?" thought Grant, puzzled. And then, when Drysdale had shut down the engine and they were approaching him with a smooth leisureliness, Lamont, coatless and hatless, sprang to his feet and then to the gunwale, as if to dive. His stockinged foot slipped on the wet gunwale. His feet went from under him. With a sickening crack that they heard quite distinctly, the back of his head hit the boat, and he disappeared under water. Grant had his coat and boots off by the time they were up to him. "Can you swim?" asked Drysdale calmly. "If not, we'll wait till he comes up." "Oh, yes," Grant said. "I can swim well enough when there is a boat there to rescue me. I think I'll have to go for him if I want him." That was a terrific crack he got, and he went over the side. 6 or 7 seconds later, a dark head broke the surface, and Grant hauled the unconscious man to the boat, and with Drysdale's help pulled him in. "Got him," he said, as he rolled the limp heap on the floor. Drysdale secured the rowing boat to the stern of Master Robert and set the engine going again. He watched with interest while Grant perfunctorily wrung his wet clothes and painstakingly examined his capture. The man was completely knocked out and was bleeding from a cut on the back of the head. "Sorry for your planking," Grant apologized as the blood collected in a little pool. "Don't worry," Drysdale said. "It will scrub. This the man you wanted?" "Yes." He considered the dark, unconscious face for a while. "What do you want him for, if it isn't an indiscreet question?" "Murder." "Really?" said Drysdale, very much as though Grant had said sheep-stealing. He considered the man again. "Is he a Dago?" "No, a Londoner." "Well, at the moment he looks very much as if he would cheat the gallows after all, doesn't he?" Grant looked sharply at the man he was tending. Was he as bad as that? Surely not. As Carninish House swam up to them from across the water, Grant said, "He was staying with the Logans at the manse. I can't very well take him back there. The hotel is the best place, I think. then the government can bear all the bother of the business. But as they floated swiftly in to the landing stage, and Pigeon, who had been on the lookout for their return, came down to meet them, Drysdale said, "The man we went for is a bit knocked out. Which room was the fire lit in for Mr. Grant?"
"The one next to yours, sir."
"Well, we'll carry this man there. Then tell Matheson to go over to Garney for Dr. Anderson, and tell the Garney Hotel people that Mr. Grant is staying the night with me, and bring over his things." Grant protested at this unnecessary generosity.
"Why, the man stuck his friend in the back," he said.
"It isn't for him I'm doing it," Drysdale smiled, "though I wouldn't condemn my worst enemy to the hotel here. But you don't want to lose your man now that you've got him. Judging entirely by appearances, you had a very fine time getting him, and by the time they had lit a smoking fire in one of the glacial bedrooms over there," he indicated the hotel on the point across the river, "and got him to bed, your man would be as good as dead. Whereas here, there is the room you would have had to wash in, all warm and ready. It is far easier and better to dump him there. And Pigeon," as the man was turning away, "keep your mouth entirely closed. This gentleman met with an accident while boating. We observed it and went to his assistance."
"Very good, sir," said Pigeon.
So Grant and Drysdale between them carried the limp head upstairs and rendered first aid in the big firelit bedroom, and then, between them, Pigeon and Grant got him to bed, while Drysdale wrote a note to Mrs. Dinmont explaining that her guest had met with a slight accident and would stay here for the night. He was suffering from slight concussion, but would they not be alarmed? Grant had just changed into some things of his host and was waiting at the bedside until dinner should be announced, when there was a knock at the door, and in answer to his "come in," Miss Dinmont walked into the room. She was bareheaded and carried a small bundle under her arm, but appeared to be completely self-possessed.
"I've brought down some things of his," she said, and went over to the bed and dispassionately examined Lamont.
For the sake of saying something, Grant said that they had sent for the doctor, but it was in his, Grant's opinion, a simple concussion. He had a cut on the back of the head.
"How did it happen?" she asked.
But Grant had been facing this difficulty all the time he was changing out of his own wet things. "We met Mr. Drysdale, and he offered to take us out. Mr. Lowe's foot slipped on the edge of the jetty, and the back of his head came in contact with it as he fell." She nodded. She seemed to be puzzling over something, and not to be able to make herself articulate.
"Well, I'm going to stay and look after him tonight. It's awfully good of Mr. Drysdale to take him in."
She untied her bundle matter-of-factly.
"Do you know, I had a presentiment this morning when we were going up the river that something was going to happen. I'm so glad it's this and nothing worse. It might have been somebody's death, and that would have been incurable."
There was a little pause, and, still busy, she said over her shoulder,
"Are you staying the night with Mr. Drysdale, too?"
Grant said yes, and on the word the door opened and Drysdale himself came in.
"Ready, Inspector? You must be hungry," he said, and then he saw Miss Dinmont.
From that moment, Grant always considered Drysdale a first-class intelligence man wasted. He didn't bat an eyelid.
"Well, Miss Dinmont, were you anxious about your truant? There isn't any need, I think. It's just a slight concussion. Dr. Anderson will be along presently."
With another woman it might have passed muster, but Grant's heart sank as he met the Dinmont's girl's intelligent eye.
"Thank you for having him here," she said to Drysdale. "There isn't much to do till he comes round, but I'll stay the night, if you don't mind, and look after him."
And then she turned to Grant and said deliberately,
"Inspector of what?"
"Schools," said Grant, on the spur of the moment, and then wished he hadn't. Drysdale, too, knew that it was a mistake, but loyally backed him up.
"He doesn't look it, does he? But then inspecting is the last resort of the unintellectual.
Is there anything I can get you before we go and eat, Miss Dinmont?
No, thank you. May I ring for the maid if I want anything?
I hope you will, and for us if you want us. We're only in the room below.
He went out and moved along the corridor, but as Grant was following, she left the room with him and drew the door to behind her.
Inspector, she said, do you think I'm a fool? Don't you realize that for 7 years I have worked in London hospitals? You can't treat me as a country innocent with any hope of success. Will you be good enough to tell me what the mystery is?
Drysdale had disappeared downstairs. He was alone with her, and he felt that to tell her another untruth would be the supreme insult. All right, Miss Dinmont, I'll tell you the truth. I didn't want you to know the truth before because I thought it might save you from feeling sorry about things, but now it can't be helped. I came from London to arrest the man you had staying with you. He knew what I had come for when I came in at tea time, because he knows me by sight. But when he came with me as far as the top of the road, he bolted. In the end, he took to a boat, and it was in diving from the boat, when we followed, that he cut his head open.
And what do you want him for?
It was inevitable. He killed a man in London.
Murder?
The word was a statement, not a question. She seemed to understand that, if it had been otherwise, the inspector would have said manslaughter.
Then his name is not Lowe?
No, his name is Lamont, Gerald Lamont. He was waiting for the inevitable feminine outburst of, I don't believe it, he wouldn't do such a thing, but it did not come.
Are you arresting him on suspicion, or did he do the thing? I'm afraid there isn't any doubt about it, Grant said gently. But my aunt, is she? How did she come to send him here?
I expect Mrs. Everett was sorry for him. She'd known him some time.
I only met my aunt once in the time I've been in London. We didn't like each other, but she didn't strike me as a person to be sorry for a wrongdoer. I'd be much more likely to believe she did the thing herself. Then he isn't even a journalist?
No, Grant said. He's a bookmaker's clerk.
Well, thank you for telling me the truth at last, she said. I must get things ready for Dr. Anderson now.
Are you still going to look after him? Grant asked involuntarily. Was the outburst of disbelief coming now?
Certainly, said this remarkable girl. The fact that he is a murderer doesn't alter the fact that he has concussion, does it? Nor does the fact that he abused our hospitality alter the fact that I'm a professional nurse? And even if it weren't for that, perhaps you know that in the old days in the Highlands, a guest received hospitality and sanctuary, even if he had his host's brother's blood on his sword. It isn't often I boast the Highlands, she added, but this is rather a special occasion.
She gave a little catch of her breath that might have been a laugh or a sob, and was probably half one, half the other, and went back into the room to look after the man who had so unscrupulously used herself and her home. Chapter 13 Marking Time Grant did not sleep well that night. There was every reason why he should have slept in all the sublime peace of the righteous man of good digestion. He had finished the work he had come to do, and his case was complete. He had had a hard day in the open, in air that was at once a stimulant and a narcotic. The dinner provided by Drysdale had been all that either a hungry man or an epicure could have wished for. The sea outside his window breathed in long, gentle sighs that were the apotheosis of content. The turf fire glowed soothingly, as no flickering bonfire of wood or coals ever does. But Grant slept badly. Moreover, there was discomfort in his mind somewhere, and like all self-analytical people, he was conscious of it and wanted to locate it so that he could drag it out to the light and say, "Goodness, is that all?" and find relief and comfort as he had so often done before. He knew quite well how that uneasiness, which ruined the comfort of his 12 mattresses of happiness, proved, on investigation, to be merely the pea of the fairy tale. But root round as he would, he could find no reason for his lack of content. He produced several reasons, examined them, and threw them away. Was it the girl? Was he being sorry for her because of her pluck and decency? But he had no real reason to think that she cared for the man other than as a friend. Her undeniable interest in him at tea might have been due merely to his being the only interesting man from her point of view in a barren countryside. Was he overtired, then? It was a long time since he had had a whole day's fishing, followed by a burst across country at a killing pace. Or was it fear that his man would even yet slip through his fingers? But Dr. Anderson had said that there was no fracture, and the man would be able to travel in a day or two. And his chances of escape now weren't worth considering, even as hypothesis. There was nothing in all the world, apparently, to worry him, and yet he had that vague uneasiness in his mind. During one of his periodical tossings and turnings, he heard the nurse go along the corridor and decided that he would get up and see if he could be of any use. He put on his dressing gown and made for the wedge of light that came from the door she had left ajar. As he went, she came behind him with a candle. "He's quite safe, Inspector," she said, and the mockery in her tone stung him as being unfair. "I wasn't asleep, and I heard you moving, and thought I might be of some use," he said, with as much dignity as one can achieve in the déshabillé of the small hours. She relented a little. "No, thank you," she said. "There's nothing to do. He's still unconscious." She pushed open the door and led him in. There was a lamp at the bedside, but otherwise the room was dark and filled with the sound of the sea. The gentle hush, which is so different from the roar of breakers on an open coast. The man, as she said, was still unconscious, and Grant examined him critically in the light of the lamp. He looked better, and his breathing was better. "He'll be conscious before morning," she said, and it sounded more like a promise than a statement. "I can't tell you how sorry I am," Grant said suddenly, "that you should have had all this, that you should have been brought into this." "Don't worry, Inspector. I'm not at all fragile. But I'd like to keep my mother and uncle from knowing about it. Can you manage that?" "Oh, I think so. We can get Dr. Anderson to prescribe south treatment for him." She moved abruptly, and he was conscious of the unhappiness of his phrase, but could see no way of remedying it, and was silent.
"Is he a bad lot?" she asked suddenly. "I mean, apart from—"
"No," said Grant. "Not as far as we know." And then, afraid that the green growth he had burned out last night might begin to shoot again and more pain be in store for her, he added, but he stuck his friend in the back.
"The man in the queue?" she said,
and Grant nodded. Even yet he was waiting momentarily for the "I don't believe it," but it did not come. He had at last met a woman whose common sense was greater than her emotions. She had known the man only 3 days. He had lied to her every hour of these days, and the police wanted him for murder. That was sufficient evidence in her clear eyes to prevent her taking any brief in his favour.
"I have just put the kettle on the gas ring in the bathroom for tea," she said. "Will you have some?"
And Grant accepted, and they drank the scalding liquid by the open window, the sea heaving below them in the strangely balmy West Coast night. And Grant went to bed again, quite sure that it was not Miss Dinmont's emotions that worried him, but still uneasy about something. And now, writing triumphant telegrams to Barker in the golden morning, with the comfortable smell of bacon and eggs, contending amiably with the fragrance of seaweed, he was still not as happy as he should have been. Miss Dinmont had come in, still in the white overall that made her look half-surgeon, half-religieuse, to say that her patient was conscious but would grant not come to him until Dr. Anderson had been. She was afraid of the excitement, and Grant had thought that eminently reasonable. "Has he just come round?" he asked. "No," she said. He had been conscious for some hours, and she went serenely away, leaving Grant wondering what had passed between patient and nurse in those few hours. Drysdale joined him at breakfast with his queer mixture of taciturnity and amiability, and arranged that he should have a real day's fishing as an offset to the distracted flogging of the water which had occupied him yesterday. Grant said that once Anderson had been and he had heard a report of his man, he would go. He supposed any telegrams could be sent down to him. "Oh, yes, there's nothing Pigeon likes like being important. He's in his element at the moment." Dr. Anderson, a little man in ancient and none too clean tweeds, said that the patient was very well indeed, even his memory was unimpaired, but he would advise Grant, whom he took to be the man's nearest friend, not to see him until this evening. It would be best to give him a day to be quiet in. And since Miss Dinmont seemed determined to look after him, they need have no fear about him. She was an excellent nurse. "When can he travel?" asked Grant. "We're in a hurry to get south." "If it is very important, the day after tomorrow, perhaps." And seeing Grant look disappointed, "Or even tomorrow, if the journey were made comfortable. It all depends on the comfort of the travel, but I wouldn't recommend it till the day after tomorrow at the earliest." "What's the hurry?" Drysdale said. "Why spoil the ship for a ha'porth of tar?" "Afraid of loose moorings," Grant said. "Don't worry. The excellent Pigeon will dote on being head warder." Then Grant turned to the surprised doctor and explained the truth of the situation. "There's no chance of his getting away if we let him stay here till he is stronger." "He's safe enough today," Anderson said. "The man isn't fit to lift a little finger at the moment. He'd have to be carried if he escaped, and I don't suppose there's anyone here who would be willing to carry him." So Grant, conscious of being entirely unreasonable and at sea with himself, agreed, wrote a second report to Barker to supplement the one he had written on the previous night, and departed to the river with Drysdale. After a day of wide content, broken only by the arrival of Pigeon's subordinate, a youth with a turned-up nose and ears that stuck out like handles, with telegrams from Barker, they came back to the house between tea and dinner, and Grant, after a wash, knocked at the door that sheltered Lamont. Miss Dinmont admitted him, and he met the black eyes of the man on the bed with a distinct feeling of relief. He was still there. Lamont was the first to speak.
"Well, you've got me," he said, drawling a little.
"Looks like it," said Grant. "But you had a good run for your money."
"Yes," agreed the man, his eyes going to Miss Dinmont and coming back at once.
"Tell me, what made you dive off the boat? What was the idea?"
"Because swimming and diving is the thing I'm best at. If I hadn't slipped, I could have got to the rocks underwater and lain there, with only my nose and my mouth out until you got tired looking for me, or the dark came. But you won. By a head."
The pun seemed to please him. There was a little silence, and Miss Dinmont said in her clear, deliberate voice,
"I think, Inspector, he's well enough to be left now. At least he won't need professional services any longer. Perhaps someone in the house would look after him tonight."
Grant deduced that this was her way of saying that the man was strong enough now to have a more adequate guard, and thankfully agreed.
"Do you want to go now? Just as soon as someone can take my place without anyone being upset."
Grant rang and explained the situation to the maid that came. "I'll stay if you would like to go now," he said, when the maid had gone, and she agreed. Grant went to the window and stood looking out at the loch. so that if she wanted to say anything to Lamont, the way was clear, and she began to collect her things. There was no sound of conversation, and looking round, he saw that she was apparently quite absorbed in the task of leaving nothing behind her, and the man was watching her unblinkingly, his whole being waiting for the moment of her leave-taking. Grant turned back to the sea, and presently he heard her say, "Shall I see you again before you go?" There was no answer to that, and Grant turned round to find that she was addressing himself. "Oh, yes, I hope so," he said. "I'll call at the manse if I don't see you otherwise, if I may."
"All right," she said. "Then I needn't say goodbye just now."
And she went out of the room with her bundle. Grant glanced at his captive and looked away at once. It is indecent to pry too far into even a murderer's soul. When he looked back again, the man's eyes were closed, and his face was a mask of such unspeakable misery that Grant was unexpectedly moved. He had cared for her then. It had not been merely opportunism. "Can I do anything for you, Lamont?" he asked presently. The black eyes opened and considered him unseeingly. "I suppose it is too much to expect anyone to believe that I didn't do it," he said at length. "It is, rather," said Grant dryly. "But I didn't, you know." "No? Well, we hardly expected you to say you did."
"That's what she said."
"Who?" asked Grant, surprised.
"Miss Dinmont, when I told her I hadn't done it."
"Oh. Well, it's a simple process of elimination, you see, and everything fits in too well for the possibility of a mistake, even down to this." And picking up Lamont's hand from where it lay on the counterpane, he indicated the scar on the inside of his thumb. "Where did you get that?"
"I got it carrying my trunk up the stairs to my new rooms in Brixton that morning."
"Well, well," said Grant indulgently. "We won't argue the affair now, and you're not well enough to make a statement. If I took one now, they'd hold it up to me that I had got it from you when you weren't compos mentis."
"My statement will be the same whenever you take it," the man said. "Only no one will believe it. If they would have believed it, I wouldn't have run."
Grant had heard that tale before. It was a favourite gambit with criminals who had no case. When a man plays injured innocence, the layman immediately considers the possibility of a mistake, but the police officer, who has a long acquaintance with the undoubtedly guilty, is less impressionable. In fact, is not impressed at all. A police officer who was impressed with a hard luck story, however well told, would be little use in a force designed for the suppression of that most plausible of creatures, the criminal. So Grant merely smiled and went back to the window. The lock was like glass this evening. The hills on either side reflected to their last detail in the still water. Master Robert rowed below the boathouse, a painted ship, only that no paint could reproduce the translucence of the sea as it was now. Presently, Lamont said, "How did you find where I had come to?"
"Fingerprints," said Grant succinctly.
"Have you got fingerprints of mine?"
"No, not yours. I'm going to take them in a minute."
"Whose, then?"
"Mrs. Everett's."
"What has Mrs. Everett got to do with it?" the man said, with the first hint of defiance.
"I expect you know more about that than I do. Don't talk. I want you to be able to travel tomorrow or the next day."
"But look here, you haven't done anything to Mrs. Everett, have you?"
Grant grinned.
"No. I think it's what Mrs. Everett's done to us."
"What do you mean? You haven't arrested her, have you?"
There was obviously no hope of the man being quiet until he knew how they had traced him, so Grant told him. "We found a fingerprint of Mrs. Everett's in your rooms, and as Mrs. Everett had told us she didn't know where your new rooms were, it was a fair conclusion that she had a finger in the pie. We found that her relations stayed here, and then we found the man you fooled at King's Cross, and his description of Mrs. Everett made things sure. We only just missed you at the Brixton place."
"Mrs. Everett won't get into trouble over it, will she?"
"Probably not, now that we've got you."
"I was a fool to run in the first place. If I'd come and told the truth in the beginning, it couldn't be any worse than it is now, and I'd have been saved all the hell between."
He was lying with his eyes on the sea.
"Funny to think that if someone hadn't killed Bert, I'd never have seen this place, or anything."
The anything the inspector took to be the manse.
And who do you think killed him?" "I don't know. There wasn't anyone I know of who'd do that to Bert. I think perhaps someone did it by mistake."
"Not looking what they were doing with the needle, as it were?"
"No, in mistake for someone else."
"And you're the left-handed man with a scar on his thumb who quarrelled with Sorrel just before his death and who has all the money Sorrel had in the world, but you're quite innocent?" The man turned his head wearily away.
"I know," he said. "You don't need to tell me how bad it is."
A knock came to the door, and the boy with the protruding ears appeared in the doorway and said that he had been sent to relieve Mr. Grant if that was what Mr. Grant wanted. Grant said, "I'll want you in 5 minutes or so. Come back when I ring." And the boy melted into the dark of the passage, grin last, like the Cheshire Cat. Grant took something out of his pocket and fiddled with it at the washstand. Then he came over to the bedside and said, "Fingerprints, please. It's quite a painless process, so you needn't mind." He took prints of both hands on the prepared sheets of paper, and the man submitted with an indifference tinged with the interest one shows in experiencing something, however mild, for the first time. Grant knew, even as he pressed the fingertips on the paper, that the man had no Scotland Yard record. The prints would be of value only in relation to the other prints in the case. As he laid them aside to dry, Lamont said, "Are you the star turn at Scotland Yard?"
"Not yet," said Grant. "You flatter yourself."
"Oh, I only thought, seeing your photograph in the paper."
"That was why you ran last Saturday night in the Strand."
"Was it only last Saturday? I wish the traffic had done for me then."
"Well, it very nearly did for me."
"Yes, I got an awful jolt when I saw you behind me so soon."
"If it's any comfort to you, I got a much worse one when I saw you arriving back in the Strand."
"What did you do then?"
"Took a taxi. There was one passing."
"Tell me," the inspector said, his curiosity getting the better of him. "Were you planning the boat escape all the time at the manse tea?"
"No, I had no plans at all. I thought of the boat afterwards only because I'm used to boats, and I thought you'd think of them last. I was going to try to escape somehow, but I didn't think of it until I saw the pepper pot as I was going out. It was the only way I could think of, you see. Bert had my gun."
"Your gun? Was that your gun in his pocket?"
"Yes, that's what I went to the queue for." But Grant did not want statements of that sort tonight. "Don't talk," he said, and rang for the boy. "I'll take any statement you want to give me tomorrow. If there's anything I can do for you tonight, tell the boy, and he'll let me know."
"There isn't anything, thank you. You've been awfully decent, far more decent than I thought the police ever were to criminals."
That was so obviously an English version of Raoul Gentil that Grant smiled involuntarily, and the shadow of a smile was reflected on Lamont's swarthy face.
"I say," he said, "I've thought a lot about Bert, and it's my belief that, if it wasn't a mistake, it was a woman."
"Thanks for the tip," said Grant dryly, and left him to the tender mercies of the grinning youth. But as he made his way downstairs, he was wondering why he had thought of Mrs. Ratcliffe.
Chapter 14. The Statement. It was not at Carninish, however, that Lamont gave his statement to the inspector, but on the journey south. Dr. Anderson, on hearing what was mooted, pleaded for one more day's rest for his patient.
You don't want the man to have information of the brain, do you?
Grant, who was dying to have a statement down in black and white, explained that the man himself was anxious to give one, and that giving it would surely harm him less than having it simmering in his brain.
It would be all right at the beginning, Anderson said, but by the time he had finished he would need another day in bed. Take my advice and leave it for the meantime.
So Grant had given way and let his captive have still longer time to burnish the tale he was no doubt concocting. No amount of burnish, he thought, thankfully, would rub out the evidence. That was there, unalterable, and nothing the man might say could upset the facts. It was as much curiosity on his part, he told himself, as fear for his case that made him so eager to hear what Lamont had to say. So he bullied himself into some show of patience. He went sea-fishing in Master Robert with Drysdale, and every chug of the motor reminded him of the fish he had landed 2 nights ago. He went to tea at the manse, and with Miss Dinmont's imperturbable face opposite him and an odd pepper-pot alongside the salt on the table, his thoughts were almost wholly of Lamont. He went to church afterwards, partly to please his host, but mainly to avoid what was evidently going to be a tete-a-tete with Miss Dinmont if he stayed behind and sat through a sermon in which Mr. Logan proved to his own and his congregation's satisfaction that the King of Kings had no use for the foxtrot, and thought continually of the statement Lamont would give him. When the incredible dreary noise of Highland praise had faded into silence for the last time, and Mr. Logan had pronounced an unctuous benediction, his one thought was that now he could go back and be near Lamont. It was rapidly becoming an obsession with him, and he recognized the fact and resented it. When Mrs. Dinmont, Miss Dinmont had not come to church, reminded him, as she was saying good night, that on the morrow the car would stop at the manse gate to allow them to say good-bye to Mr. Lowe, it came as a shock to him that there was more play-acting to be done before he departed from Carninish. But things proved easier than he had anticipated. Lamont played up as he had played up during the fateful tea, and neither his host nor his hostess suspected that there was anything more serious amiss than the matter of his health. Miss Dinmont was not present.
"Dandy said she had already said good-bye to you, and it is unlucky to say good-bye twice," her mother said. "She said you had been unlucky enough already. Are you a very unlucky person, then?"
"Very," said Lamont, with an admirable smile. And as the car moved away, Grant took out the handcuffs. "Sorry," he said brusquely. "It's only till we reach the railway." But Lamont merely repeated the word, "unlucky," as if, surprisingly, he liked the sound of it. At the station they were joined by a plain-clothes man, and at Inverness had a compartment to themselves. And it was after dinner that night, when the last light was going on the hills, that Lamont, pale and rather ill-looking, offered again to tell them all he knew.
"It isn't much," he said, "but I want you to know."
"You realize that what you say may be used against you?" Grant said. "Your lawyer would probably want you to say nothing. You see, it's putting your line of defense into our hands." And even while he was saying it, he was wondering, "Why am I so punctilious? I've told him already that anything he says may be used against him." But Lamont wanted to talk, and so the constable produced his notebook. "Where shall I begin?" Lamont asked. "It's difficult to know where to start." "Suppose you tell us how you spent the day Sorrel was murdered. That's a week last Tuesday, the 13th. "Well, in the morning we packed. Bert was leaving for America that night, and I took my things to my new room in Brixton, and he took his to Waterloo." Here the inspector's heart missed a beat. Fool! He'd forgotten all about the man's luggage. He had been so hot on the false scent of the Ratcliffes, and then on the trail of Lamont, that he hadn't had time to see the thing under his nose. Not that it was of supreme importance, in any case. That took us till lunchtime. We had lunch in the Coventry Street Lions.
Whereabouts?
In a corner table on the first floor.
Yes, go on, All the time we were having lunch, we argued as to whether I was going to see him off or not. I wanted to go down to Southampton with him and see him sail, but he wouldn't let me come even to the boat train at Waterloo. He said there wasn't anything in the world he hated like being seen off, especially when he was going a long way. I remember he said, "If a chap's not going far, then there's no need, and if he's going to the other side of the world, then there's no good. What's a few minutes more or less?" Then, in the afternoon, we went to the Woffington to see Didn't You Know.
"What?" said Grant. "You went to the show at the Woffington in the afternoon?"
"Yes, that was arranged a long time beforehand. Bert had booked seats, stalls. It was a sort of final do, celebration. At the interval, he told me that he was going to join the pit queue for the evening performance as soon as we got out. He had gone a lot to Didn't You Know. It was a sort of craze, in fact. We both went a lot and said that we'd say goodbye then. It seemed a poor way to me to say goodbye to a pal you'd known as well as I knew Bert, but he was always a bit unaccountable, and anyhow, if he didn't want me, I wasn't going to insist on being with him. So we said goodbye outside the front of the Woffington, and I went back to Brixton to unpack my things. I was feeling awfully fed up, because Bert and I had been such pals that I hadn't any others worth mentioning, and it was lonely at Brixton after Mrs. Everett's.
Didn't you think of going with Sorrel?
I wanted to, all right, but I hadn't the money. I hoped for a while that he'd offer to lend me it. He knew that I'd pay him back all right, but he never did. I was a bit sore about that, too. Every way I was pretty fed up. And Bert himself didn't appear to be happy about it. He hung on to my hand like anything when we were saying goodbye, and he gave me a little packet and said I was to promise not to open it till the day after tomorrow. That was the day after he sailed. I thought it was a sort of farewell present, and didn't think anything more about it. It was a little white packet done up in paper, like jewellers use, and as a matter of fact I thought it was a watch. My watch was always going crazy. He used to say, "If you don't get a new watch, Jerry, you won't be in time for Kingdom Come, even." Lamont choked suddenly and stopped. He carefully wiped away the steam on the window and then resumed. "Well, when I was unpacking my things in Brixton, I missed my revolver. I never used the thing, of course. It was just a war souvenir. I had a commission, though you mightn't think it, and I tell you straight, I'd rather 1,000 times be for it wire-cutting or anything else like that than be hunted round London by the police. It isn't so bad in the open, more like a game somehow, but in London it's like being in a trap. Didn't you feel that it wasn't so deadly awful out in the country somehow?" "Yes," admitted the inspector, "I did, but I didn't expect you to. I thought you'd be happier in town."
"Happy? God!" said Lamont, and was silent, evidently living it over again.
"Well," prompted the inspector, "you missed your revolver?"
"Yes, I missed it, and though I didn't use it, it used to be kept locked in a drawer at Mrs. Everett's. I knew exactly where I had put it when I was packing. Whereabouts in the trunk, I mean. And as it was only that morning I had packed, I was just taking things out in the reverse order from the way I'd put them in, and so I missed it at once. And then I grew frightened somehow, though even yet I can't tell you why. I began to remember how quiet Bert had been lately. He was always quiet, but lately he had been more so. Then I thought he might just have wanted a gun going to a strange country. But then I thought he might have asked for it. He knew I'd have given it to him if he asked for it. Anyway, I was sort of frightened, though I couldn't tell you just why, and I went straight back to the queue and found him. He had a good place, about 1/3 of the way down, so I think he had had a boy to keep his place for him. He must have meant it all the time to go back on his last night. He was sentimental, Bert. I asked him if he had taken my revolver, and he admitted it. I don't know why I grew so scared then, all of a sudden. Looking back, doesn't seem to be anything to be scared about.
your pal, having taken your revolver. But I was, and I lost my head and said, "Well, I want it back right now." And he said, "Why?" And I said, "Because it's my property and I want it." He said, "You're a mean skunk, Jerry. Can't I borrow anything of yours even when I'm going half round the world and you're going to stay in little safe old London?" But I stuck to having it back. Then he said, "Well, you'll have a sweet time unpacking my things for it, but I'll give you the key and the ticket." It was only then that it occurred to me that I had taken it for granted that he had the revolver on him. I began to feel small and to feel I'd made a fool of myself. I always did things first and thought afterwards, and Bert always thought for ages about a thing and then would do exactly as he had intended to. We were opposites in lots of ways. So I told him to keep his ticket and the revolver too and went away. Now, there had been no cloakroom ticket found in Sorrel's possession. "Did you see the ticket?" "No, he only offered to give it to me." Next morning I was late because I wasn't used to doing for myself, and I had to make my own breakfast and tidy up. But I didn't hurry because I had no job. I was hoping to get a clerk's place when the flat started. It was nearly 12 when I went out, and I wasn't thinking of anything but Bert. I was so fed up with the way we'd parted and the fool I'd made of myself that I went to a post office and sent a wire to Bert, addressed to the Queen of Arabia, saying, "Sorry, Jerry." "What post office did you send the telegram from?" "The one in Brixton High Street." "All right, go on." I bought a paper and went back to my rooms, and then I saw about the Kew murder. It didn't give any description of the man, except that he was young and fair, and I didn't connect him with Bert. When I thought of Bert, I always thought of him aboard ship by this time. Do you see? If the man had been shot, I'd have been alarmed at once. But stuck with a knife was different. At this stage, Grant looked with incredulous astonishment at Lamont. Was the man by any remotest possibility telling the truth? If not, he was the most cold-blooded wretch Grant had ever had the unhappy lot to meet. But the man appeared unconscious of Grant's scrutiny. He seemed wholly absorbed in his story. If this was acting, it was the best Grant had ever seen, and he deemed himself a connoisseur. On Thursday morning, when I was clearing up, I remembered Bert's parcel and opened it, and inside was all Bert's cash. I was flabbergasted, and somehow I was scared again. If anything had happened to Bert, I'd have heard about it. I mean, I thought I would have, but I didn't like it. There was no note with it. He had said when he handed it over, "This is for you," and made me promise not to open it till the time he said. I didn't know what to do about it, because I still thought of Bert as being on the way to New York. I went out and got a paper. They had all big headlines about the Kew murder, and this time there was a full description of the man and his clothes and the contents of his pockets. That was in black type. And I knew at once it was Bert. I got on a bus feeling sick all over, but meaning to go to Scotland Yard right away and tell them all I knew about it. On the bus, I read the rest of the thing. It said that the murder had been done by someone left-handed and wanted to know who had left the queue. Then I remembered that we had had an argument that anyone might have overheard, and that I had all Bert's money without a single thing to show how I got it. I got off the bus in an awful sweat and walked about thinking what was to be done. The more I thought about it, the more it seemed that I couldn't go to Scotland Yard with a tale like that. I was torn between that and letting Bert lie there while the skunk that killed him went free. I was about crazy that day. I thought that if I didn't go, perhaps they'd get on to the track of the right man, and then I'd wonder if I was using that as an excuse for not going, funking, you know. My thoughts went round and round like that, and I couldn't come to any decision.
On Friday they said the inquest was to be that day, and that no one had claimed to know Bert. There was one time during that day that I very nearly went to the police station, and then, just when the thought of Bert had got my courage up, I remembered what a thin yarn I had about myself. So instead I sent some of Bert's money to bury him. I'd have liked to say who he was, but I knew that would bring them all about me in a minute. And then, next morning, I saw they had my description. They were looking for me. I'd have gone then of my own accord. Only in the description it said that the man had a scar on the inside of his finger or thumb. That tore it. I got that scar. He extended his hand, as I told you, carrying my trunk up the stairs to my room. The buckle caught me as I was letting it down. But that tore it all right. Who would believe me now? I waited till it was late afternoon, and then I went to Mrs. Everett. She was the only real friend I had, and she knew me. I told her every last thing about it. She believed me because she knew me, you see. But even she saw that no one who didn't know me would believe me. She called me a fool, or as good as, for not going straight away to tell what I knew. She would have. She ruled us both. Bert used to call her Lady Macbeth, because she was Scotch and used to screw us up to doing things when we were wavering about them. She said all I could do now was to lie low. If they didn't find me, there was always the chance of their getting on to the right man, and afterwards she would give me the money to go abroad. I couldn't use Bert somehow. When I left her, I went all the way into town because I couldn't bear the thought of going back to my rooms with nothing to do but listen for feet on the stairs. I thought I would be safest in a movie show, and I meant to go up to the Haymarket. And then I looked back in the Strand and saw you behind me. You know that bit. I went back to my rooms at once and didn't stir out of them till Mrs. Everett came on Monday and told me you'd been to her. She came to King's Cross with me and gave me the introduction to the people at Carninish. You know the rest. After I'd been a day in Carninish, I began to think I had a chance, until I saw you come into the room for tea. He lapsed into silence. Grant noticed that his hands were trembling. What made you think that the money you say Sorrel left with you was all he had? Because it was the amount he had in his own private account at the bank. It was I who drew it for him more than a week before he was due to sail. He drew it all but a pound. Were you in the habit of drawing money for him? No, hardly ever. But that week he was terribly busy settling affairs at the office and clearing up generally. Why did he draw it so soon if he did not need it to pay his fare, as he evidently didn't? I don't know, unless he was afraid he wouldn't have enough in the business account to pay off all the accounts. But he had. He didn't leave a halfpenny owing. Was business good? Yes, not bad. As good as it ever is in the winter. We do very little national hunt betting. Did, I mean. During the flat, it was good enough. At the end of the winter would be a lean season with Sorrel, then? Yes. And you handed the money to Sorrel? When? Directly I got back from the bank. You say you quarrelled with Sorrel about the revolver. Can you prove the revolver was yours? No, how can I? No one knew about it because it was locked up. No one but Bert, I mean. It was loaded. Just the way it was when the armistice came. It wasn't a thing to leave about. And what do you suggest that Sorrel wanted it for? I don't know. I haven't the remotest idea. I did think of suicide. It looked like that, but then there was no reason for it. When you said to me at Carninish that, in your opinion, a woman had killed Sorrel, what did you mean? Well, you see, I knew all Bert's men friends, and he didn't have any girl ones. I mean girls that are more than acquaintances, but I always thought there might have been a woman before I knew him. He was very quiet about the things he cared about, and he wouldn't have told me in any case. I have seen him sometimes get letters in a woman's handwriting, but he never remarked about them, and Bert wasn't the kind you teased about that sort of thing.
Has a letter of that sort arrived for him lately? Within the past 6 months, eh?
Lamont thought for a while and said yes, he thought so.
What kind of writing?
Biggish, with very round letters.
You have read the description of the dagger that killed Sorrel. Have you ever handled one like it?
I not only never handled one, but I never saw one.
Have you any suggestions as to who or what this hypothetical woman might have been?
No.
Do you mean to say that you were this man's intimate friend for years, actually lived with him for 4 years, and yet know nothing of his past?
I know quite a lot about his past, but not that.
You didn't know Bert, or you wouldn't expect him to tell me. He wasn't secretive in ordinary things, only in special things.
Why was he going to America?
I don't know. I told you, I thought he hadn't been happy lately. He never was exactly bubbling over. But lately, well, it's been more of an atmosphere than anything you could give a name to.
Was he going alone?
Yes.
Not with a woman?
Certainly not, said Lamont sharply, as if Grant had insulted him or his friend.
How do you know?
Lamont hunted round in his mind, evidently at a loss. He was quite obviously facing the possibility for the first time that his friend had intended to go abroad with someone and had not told him. Grant could see him considering the proposition and rejecting it.
I don't know how I know, but I do know. He would have told me that.
Then you deny having any knowledge as to how Sorrel met his end.
I do. Don't you think if I had any knowledge, I'd tell you all I knew?
I expect you would, said Grant.
The very vagueness of your suspicions is a bad feature in your line of defence.
He asked the constable to read out what he had written, and Lamont agreed that it coincided with what he had said, and signed each page with a none too steady hand. As he signed the last, he said,
"I'm feeling rotten. Can I lie down now?"
And Grant gave him a draught, which he had cadged from the doctor, and in 15 minutes the prisoner was sleeping, the sleep of utter exhaustion, while his captor stayed awake and thought the statement over. It was an extraordinarily plausible one. It fitted and dovetailed beautifully. Except for its fundamental improbability, it was difficult to fault it. The man had had an explanation for everything. Times and places, even motives, fitted. His account of his supposed emotions, from the discovery of the loss of the revolver onwards, was a triumph of verisimilitude. Was it possible, even remotely possible, that the man's statement was true? Was this that thousandth case where circumstantial evidence, complete in every particular, was merely a series of accidents, completely unrelated, and lying colossally in consequence? But then, the thinness of the man's story, that fundamental improbability. After all, he had had nearly a fortnight to carve out his explanation, plane it, polish it, and make it fit in every particular. It would be a poor wit that would not achieve a tolerably acceptable tale, with life itself at stake. That there was no one to check the truth or otherwise of the vital points was at once his misfortune and his advantage. It occurred to Grant that the only way to check Lamont's explanation was to unearth Sorrel's story. For story, Grant felt, there must be. If he could discover that Sorrel really intended suicide, it would go far to substantiate Lamont's story of the purloined revolver and the gift of money. And there Grant pulled himself up. Substantiate Lamont's story? Was there a possibility of such a thing coming to pass? If that was so, his whole case went up in smoke. Lamont was not guilty, and he had arrested the wrong man. But was there within the bounds of possibility a coincidence which would put in one theatre cue two men, both left-handed, both scarred on a finger of that hand, and both acquaintances of the dead man, and therefore his potential murderers. He refused to believe it. It was not the credibility of the man's tale which had thrown dust in his eyes, but the extraordinary credibility of the man.